Welcome back with Jeremy Schaaf from ESPN, who's written a book, Triumph, about the story of Jesse Owens. And let's start first with the backdrop of the reality of the mid-30s in Depression America and what Jesse Owens had to deal with.
Well, I mean, you got to remember, Nick, Jesse Owens, at the time he goes to Berlin, is only 22 years old. He is the grandson of slaves. He is the son of an Alabama sharecropper. When he's 9 years old, the family moves to Cleveland, a significant improvement over the Deep South at that time for most blacks, but, you know, still a very, very segregated society. Some of the indignities that he had to suffer are almost unimaginable now. I mean, Jesse Owens couldn't live in a regular dorm at Ohio State University. He's arguably the most famous product of that school. He couldn't live on campus. It was hard, obviously, as hard as it was for everyone at that time to get jobs, to get good-paying jobs. It was much harder if you happen to be black. His family goes to New York to meet him when he's on his way back from the Olympics. They can't stay in any nice hotels, and the one hotel that will take them makes them take the service entrance in the back. So, you know, the situation in particular for a black man in the United States, even one as gifted and popular and successful as Jesse Owens, was obviously something today that is, an embarrassment to us.
And the reality is Jesse Owens had actually tied several world records in high school, yet he was not even offered a scholarship.
Well, you know, it was complicated. There were certainly a lot of schools that wanted him. Athletic scholarships, as we now know them, did not as such exist back then. He had to take jobs to pay his tuition. By the time he got to college, he had a child back in Cleveland that he had to try to help to support. And considering how dire the circumstances were for most Americans in the mid-1930s, Jesse actually did okay for himself because of his athletic ability. He got a paying job at the Ohio State Legislature as a page. You know, they paid him, $160, not a week, but over the course of a semester, which was not totally insignificant at the time, but such a different situation. We're talking about one of the elite athletes in the world, and he had to pump gas while he was going to school several hours a day and practicing several hours a day just to make ends meet.
And it's interesting that even then there were racy tabloid stories of romantic trysts and questions about... Tell me about the questions about the genetic advantages of black athletes.
Oh, well, this is at the very beginning, really, of the ascendancy of the African-American athlete. It's even, you could say, before it. Jesse Owens and his teammates, his African-American teammates, are the first large contingent of African-Americans to represent the U.S. at the Olympics. There had been a few in 1932, a few in 1928 and 1924, but the African-American track athlete takes over at the 36 Olympics. Joe Louis is this undefeated heavyweight challenger, a phenomenon. Everywhere you look, blacks are coming to the fore in sports outside of professional team sports where they were not allowed to play at the time. So, pop anatomy lessons at the time suggested that, you know, there must be some inherent physical advantage for African Americans. It was popularly thought that they had longer heel bones, which made them faster. It was thought that they had quicker response times naturally than whites. And Jesse, in the summer of 1935, after he sets a bevy of world records at the Big Ten Championships, this very prominent black physician by the name of William Montague Cobb undertakes all these experiments to measure Jesse's calf girth and the length of his heel bone, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. He was an anatomy expert. And this was covered nationally on the front page of the papers. And, of course, William Montague Cobb, proved that there are no inherent advantages. There is no difference. Blacks don't have longer heel bones. There's nothing like that to satisfy everyone's desire to understand why blacks were suddenly excelling in a way that they hadn't before. And the real answer was that they were finally getting opportunities to prove how good they were.
Well, let's move on to one of the great accomplishments of this book, Jeremy Schaaf, which is to explode some of the myths about Hitler snubbing American athletes that were black and Jewish. Tell us what really happened in these Olympics. And also, wasn't there a boycott movement that has since been largely forgotten?
Well, yeah, the U.S. came very, very close, Nick, to not going to the Games at all in 1936. Germany had both the Winter and the Summer Games that year, the Winter Games down in Bavaria, the Summer Games obviously up in Prussia and Berlin. And for very good reasons, the U.S., there was a strong movement in the U.S. led by an Irish Catholic, New York City Democratic legislator and judge by the name of Jeremiah T. Mahoney. He wanted to boycott the Games. He was the head of the Amateur Athletic Union. On the other side was the head of the American Olympic Committee, Avery Brundage, who was very much for the Games and a fan, quite frankly, of Nazi Germany.
And he was in charge for right up until, what, the 80s, wasn't it?
Until 1976, Montreal. He goes from being the head of the American Olympic Committee to being the head of the International Olympic Committee after World War II.
And, isn't that a little frightening?
Very frightening. Well, Avery Brundage is best remembered probably for 1972 after the massacre in Munich, saying the Games must go on. I mean, a stunning lack of sensitivity to what had happened with the massacre of the Israeli athletes. But that was his character all the way back to 1936 when he campaigned quite aggressively to put the Games in Germany. And, you know, we have to look at it from the perspective of people in 1936. Clearly, it was apparent to anybody who was trying to learn about what was going on in Germany that Hitler's regime had evil intentions, that it sought to dehumanize its Jewish citizens and subjects. In fact, they took away their citizenship. But Brundage represented the school of thought that we shouldn't mix politics with sport, kind of ignoring the fact that it was Hitler who was mixing politics with sport. And, you know, you do have to remember, though, that in 1936, not even very few German Jews would have even predicted that Hitler would attempt to annihilate European Jewry. Clearly, he had bad intentions, but how bad, no one knew. And that only somewhat kind of mitigates the decision of the United States to take part in those Games, because the U.S. shouldn't have been there. The U.S. should not have in any way been legitimizing the Third Reich at that point, which is what those Olympic Games did. But of course, if
so, the reality is, even though this story that you're talking about does a lot to annihilate the theory or the ideology of Aryan supremacy, the reality is it did legitimize Hitler in a way that few other things could have.
No, there's no doubt about that. I mean, Jesse Owens goes to Berlin and he refutes the theory of Aryan supremacy, and to that extent, he embarrasses Germany. But you have to remember that was not a surprise. Jesse Owens and his teammates were the greatest athletes in the world, and the Germans knew that the black American athletes were going to go there and win. There was no way they couldn't win. Taking that into consideration, they still thought that the Games would be great propaganda because it would give them an opportunity to display all of the good things that Hitler had done for a non-Jewish German society to that point. And most visitors, being rather naive and susceptible to the charms of the German propagandists, bought into that. Ultimately, I think as great as Jesse Owens' performance was there and everything that it meant, in hindsight, there's no way that the U.S. should have been at those Games.
When we come back, let's talk with Jeremy Schaff some more about a very interesting, curious, and powerful friendship with his German rival, broad jumper Luce Long, and what that meant and how that helped create some other realities in terms of relationships between blacks, between Germans, and what this Olympics truly meant in the canvas of history itself. We're talking about the book Triumph by Jeremy Schaff. We'll be right back on Head Games Radio on Sirius Satellite and Sports Byline. Stay with us.